Side 13. Down at the Emsworth Arms, a servitor informed Lord Tilbury that he was wanted on the telephone. He walked to the instrument broodingly. The bodkin popinjay, he presumed, that broken reed on which he had foolishly supposed that it would be possible to lean. He prepared to be a little terse with Monty. Ever since his interview with Monty in the garden of the Emsworth Arms, Lord Tilbury had found his thoughts turning wistfully to the one man of his acquaintance who could have been relied upon to put through this commission of his. During the years when P. Frobisher Pilbeam had worked on his staff as editor of Society Spice, Lord Tilbury had never actually asked him to steal anything, but he had no doubt at all that, if adequately paid, Percy would have sprung to the task. And now that he was blossoming out as a private investigator, it was probable that he would spring to it with an even greater readiness. All that afternoon, Lord Tilbury had been wondering whether the solution of the whole thing would not be to send Pilbeam a wire, telling him to come at once. What deterred him was the reflection that it would be impossible to get him into the castle. You cannot insert private inquiry agents in country houses as if you were slipping ferrets down a rabbit hole. This it was that had made him abandon the roseate dream, and it was the fact that he had been compelled to abandon it that lent additional asperity to his manner as he now took up the receiver.
"Yes," he said curtly. "Well?"
A rollicking voice nearly cracked his eardrum.
"Hello there, Tilbury. This is Pilbeam."
Lord Tilbury's eyes seemed to shoot out suddenly, like a snail's. This was the most amazing coincidence he'd ever experienced. More a miracle, he felt with some awe, than a mere coincidence.
"Speaking from Blandings Castle, Tilbury."
"What?" The receiver shook in Lord Tilbury's hands. Was this what was known as the direct answer to prayer? Or, taking the gloomier view, was he undergoing some aural hallucination?
"Speaking from Blandings Castle, Tilbury," repeated the voice. "You don't mind me calling you Tilbury, do you, Tilbury?"
it asked solicitously.
"I'm a bit tight."
"Pilbeam," Lord Tilbury's voice shook. "Did I really understand you to say that you were speaking from Blandings Castle?"
"Quite."
A man capable of building up the Mammoth Publishing Company is not a man who wastes time in unnecessary questions. Others might have asked Pilbeam how he had got there, but not Lord Tilbury. He could do all that later.
"Pilbeam," he said, "this is providential. Kindly come to me here as soon as possible. There's something I wish you to do for me, most urgent."
"A commission?"
"Yes, a commission."
"And what?"
inquired the voice playfully, yet with a certain metallic note.
"Is there in it for me?"
Lord Tilbury thought rapidly.
£100.
A hideous noise sent his head jerking back. It was apparently a derisive laugh. When it was repeated more softly a moment later, he recognized it as such.
"200, Pilbeam."
"Listen, Tilbury, I know what it is you want me to do. Oh, yes, I know. It's something to do with a certain book."
"Yes, yes."
"Then let me tell you, Tilbury, that I've been offered 500 in another quarter and can easily work it up to a level 1,000. But seeing it's you, I won't sting you for more than that. Think on your feet, Tilbury. 1,000 is the figure."
Lord Tilbury thought on his feet. There were few people in England whom the prospect of parting with £1,000 afflicted with a greater sensation of nausea, but he could speculate in order to accumulate. And in the present case, what was a mere 1,000? A sprat to catch a whale.
"Very well."
"It's a deal?"
"Yes, I agree."
"Right,"
said the voice with renewed cheeriness.
"Be in after dinner tonight. I'll bring the thing down with me."
"What?"
"I say I'll bring you know what to you after dinner tonight. And now, arriva. Well, whatever it is. Tilbury, old cock. Au revoir, Tilbury. I'm feeling rather funny and I think I'll get a bit of sleep. I think I'll go home, Tilbury. Pip, pip.
There was a click at the other end of the wire. Pilbeam had hung up. Fingers tried the handle of Pilbeam's bedroom door. A fist banged on the panel. The detective looked up frowningly from the bed on which he lay. He had been on the point of sinking into a troubled doze.
"Who's that?"
"Open this door and I'll show you who it is."
"Is that old Galley?"
"Damn your impudence."
"What do you want?"
"A little talk with you, young man."
"Go away, old Galley," said Pilbeam. "Don't want any little talks. Trying to get some sleep, old Galley. Tell him I'm sharp down to dinner, feeling funny."
You'll feel even funnier if I can get in.
Ah, but you can't get in,
Pilbeam pointed out. And, laughing softly to himself at the wit and cleverness of the retort, he sank back on the pillows and closed his eyes again. The handle rattled once more. The door creaked as a weight was pressed against it. Then there was silence, broken shortly by a rhythmic snoring. Percy Pilbeam slept. Chapter 13. Darkness had fallen on Blandings Castle, the soft, caressing darkness that closes in like a velvet curtain at the end of a summer day. Now slept the crimson petal and the white. Owls hooted in the shadows. Bushes rustled as the small creatures of the night went about their mysterious business. The scent of the wet earth mingled with the fragrance of stock and of wallflower. Bats wheeled against the starlit sky, and moths blundered in and out of the shaft of golden light that shone from the window of the dining room. It was the hour when men forget their troubles about the friendly board. But troubles like those now weighing upon the inmates of Blandings Castle are not to be purged by meat and drink. The soup had come and gone, the fish had come and gone, the entree had come and was going, but still there hung over the table a fog-like pall of gloom. Of all those silent diners, not one but had his hidden care. Even Lord Emsworth, who was not easily depressed, found his meal entirely spoiled by the fact that it was being shared by Sir Gregory Parslow. As for Sir Gregory himself, the news communicated to him over the telephone by Lady Constance Keeble an hour before had been enough to ruin a dozen dinners. His might have been, as his whilom playmate, the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, had made so abundantly clear in chapters 4, 7, 11, 18, and 24 of his immortal work, a frivolous youth, but in his late 50s he was taking life extremely seriously. Very earnest was his wish to represent the Unionist Party as their member for Bridgeford and Chifley Parliamentary Division of Shropshire, and if Pilbeam fulfilled his threat of taking that infernal manuscript to Lord Tilbury, his chances of doing so would be simply nil. He knew that local committee. Once let the story of the prawns appear in print, and they would drop him like a hot brick. He had come tonight to reason with Pilbeam, to plead with Pilbeam, to appeal to Pilbeam's better feelings, if such existed. And dash it, there was no Pilbeam to be reasoned with, to be pleaded with, or to be appealed to. Where was the damn fella? The same question was torturing Lady Constance. Where was Pilbeam? Could he have gone straight to Lord Tilbury after taking his zigzag departure from the drawing-room? It was Lord Emsworth who put the question into words. For some moments he'd been staring down the table over the top of his crooked pince-nez in a puzzled manner, like that of a cat trying to run over the muster-roll of its kittens. "Which?" "Milord," said that careworn man hollowly. Foxes were gnawing at Beach's victuals, too.
"Beach, I can't see Mr. Pilbeam. Can you see Mr. Pilbeam, Beach? He doesn't seem to be here."
"Mr. Pilbeam is in his bedroom, my lord. He informed the footman who knocked at the door with his hot water that he would not be among those present at dinner, my lord, owing to a headache." The Honourable Galahad endorsed this.
"I knocked at his door just before the dressing gong went, and he said he wanted to go to sleep." "You didn't go in?"
"No. You should have gone in, Galahad. The poor fellow may be feeling unwell."
"Not so unwell as he would have been if I could have got in."
"You think you would have made his headache worse?"
"A good deal worse," said Honourable Galahad, taking a salted almond and giving it a hard look through his monocle.
The news that Pilbeam was on a bed of sickness acted on three members of the party, rather as the recent rain had acted on the parched earth. Lady Constance seemed to expand like a refreshed flower. Lady Julia did the same. Sir Gregory Parslow, in addition to expanding, gave such a sharp sigh of relief that he blew a candle out. Three pairs of eyes exchanged glances. There was the same message of cheer in each of them. If Pilbeam had not taken the irrevocable step, those eyes said, all might yet be well.
"God bless my soul," said Lord Emsworth solicitously. "I hope he isn't really bad. These infernal thunderstorms are enough to give anyone a headache. I had a slight headache myself before dinner. I'll run up and see the poor chap as soon as we've finished here. My goodness, I don't want Pilbeam on the sick list now of all times.
said Lord Emsworth, with a glance at Sir Gregory so full of meaning that the latter, who was lifting his wine glass to his lips, shied like a startled horse and spilled half its contents.
"Why now, particularly?" asked Lady Julia. "Never mind," said Lord Emsworth darkly.
"I only asked," said Lady Julia, "because I personally consider that all times are good times for Mr. Pilbeam to have headaches, not to mention bots, glanders, quartan ague, frog in the throat, and the Black Death." A soft, sibilant sound, like gas escaping from a pipe, came from the shadows by the sideboard. It was Beach expressing, as far as butlerine etiquette would permit him to express, his adhesion to this sentiment. Lord Emsworth, on the other hand, showed annoyance.
"I wish you wouldn't say such things, Julia."
"On the spur of the moment, I couldn't think of anything worse."
"Don't you like Pilbeam?"
"My dear Clarence, don't be fantastic. Nobody likes Mr. Pilbeam. There are people who do not actually put poison in his soup, but that is as far as you can go."
"I disagree with you," said Lord Emsworth warmly. "I regard him as a capital fellow, capital, and most useful, let me tell you." "Attempts are being made," said Lord Emsworth, once more sniping Sir Gregory with a penetrating eye, "by certain parties, whom I will not name, to injure my pig. Pilbeam is helping me thwart them. Thanks to his advice, I have now put my pig where the parties to whom I allude will not find it quite so easy to get at her. Let me tell you that I think very highly of Pilbeam. I've a good mind to send him up half a bottle of champagne."
"Making the perfect example of carrying coals to Newcastle."
"Eh?
Oh, nothing. 'Twas but a passing jest."
"Champagne is good for headaches," argued Lord Emsworth. "It might make all the difference to Pilbeam."
"Are we to spend the whole of dinner talking of Mr. Pilbeam and his headache?" demanded Lady Constance imperiously. "I am sick and tired of Mr. Pilbeam, and I don't want to hear any more of that pig of yours, Clarence. For goodness sake, let us discuss some reasonable topic."
This bright invitation having had the not unnatural effect of killing the conversation completely, dinner proceeded in an unbroken silence. Only once did one of the revellers venture a remark. As Beach and his assistants removed the plates which had contained fruit salad and substituted others designed for dessert, Lady Julia raised her glass.
"To the body upstairs,
I hope," she said. Percy Pilbeam, however, was not actually dead. At the precise moment of Lady Julia's toast, almost as if he were answering a cue, he sat up on his bed and stared muzzily about him. The fact that the room was now in darkness made it difficult for him to find his bearings immediately, and for perhaps half a minute he sat wondering where he was. Then memory returned, and with it an opening and shutting sensation in the region of the temples which made him regret that he had gone on sleeping. Even if he had had the Black Death to which Lady Julia had so feelingly alluded, he could not have felt very much worse. There are heads which are proof against overindulgence in champagne. That of the Honourable Galahad Threepwood is one that springs to the mind. Pilbeam's, however, did not belong to this favoured class. For a while he sat there, wincing at each fresh wave of agony. Then, levering himself up, he switched on the light and hobbled to the washstand, where he proceeded to drink deeply out of the water jug. This done, he filled the basin and started to give himself first aid treatment. Presently, a little restored, he returned to the bed and sat down again. Endeavouring to recall the events which had led up to the tragedy, he found that he could do so only sketchily. One fact alone stood out clearly in his recollection, to wit, that in some way which he could not quite remember, he had been insulted by Lady Constance Keeble. A great bitterness against Lady Constance began to burgeon within Percy Pilbeam, and it was not long before he reached the decision that, cost what it might, she must be scored off. There would be no auction sale. As soon as he felt physically capable of moving, he would take that manuscript to Lord Tilbury at the Emsworth Arms. At this point in his meditations, the house was blown up by a bomb, or, what amounted to much the same thing as far as the effect on the nervous system was concerned, there was a knock at the door.
"May I come in, dear fella?"
Pilbeam recognized the voice. He could not be rude to his only friend at Blandings Castle. He swallowed his heart again and unlocked the door.
"Ah, sitting up, I see. Feeling a little better, eh? We all missed you at dinner, said Lord Emsworth, beginning to potter about the room as he pottered about all rooms which he honoured with his presence. We wondered what had become of you. My sister Julia, if I remember rightly, speculated as to the possibility of your having got the Black Death. What put the idea into her head, I cannot imagine. Absurd, of course. People don't get the Black Death nowadays. I've never heard of anyone getting the Black Death. In fact, said Lord Emsworth, with a burst of confidence, dropping into the fireplace the hairbrush which he had been attempting to balance on the comb, I don't believe I know what the Black Death is. A sense of being in hell stole over Percy Pilbeam. What with the clatter of that brush, which had set his head aching again, and his host's conversation, which threatened to make it ache still more, he was sore beset. No doubt all that has happened, proceeded Lord Emsworth, moving the soap dish a little to the left, the water bottle a little to the right, a chair a little nearer the door, and another chair a little nearer the window, is that that thunderstorm gave you a headache. And I was wondering, my dear fellow, if a breath of fresh air might not do you good. Fresh air is often good for headaches. I'm on my way to have a look at the Empress, and it crossed my mind that you might care to come with me. It is a beautiful night. There's a lovely moon, and I have an electric torch. Here, Lord Emsworth, pausing from tapping the mirror with a button hook, produced from his pocket the torch in question and sent a dazzling ray shooting into his companion's inflamed eyes. The action decided Pilbeam. To remain longer in the confined space of a bedroom with this man would be to subject his sanity to too severe a test. He said he would be delighted to come and take a look at the Empress. Out on the gravel drive, he began to feel a little better. As Lord Emsworth had said, it was a beautiful night. Pilbeam was essentially a creature of the city, with urban tastes, but even he could appreciate the sweet serenity of the grounds of Landings Castle under that gracious moon. So restored did he feel by the time they had gone 100 yards or so, that he even ventured on a remark.
"Aren't we," he asked, "going the wrong way?" "What's that, my dear fella?" said Lord Emsworth, wrenching his mind from the torch, which he was flashing on and off like a child with a new toy. "What did you say? Don't you get to the sty by crossing the terrace?" "Ah, but you've forgotten, my dear Pilbeam. Acting on your advice, we moved her to the new one just before dinner. You recollect advising us to move her from her old sty?"
"Of course, quite. Yes, I remember."
Pirbright didn't like it. I could tell that by the strange noises he made at the back of his throat. He has some idea that she will feel restless and unhappy away from her old home, but I was particularly careful to wait and see that she was comfortably settled in, and I could detect no signs of restlessness whatever. She proceeded to eat her evening meal with every indication of enjoyment.
Good, said Pilbeam, feeling distrait.
Eh?
I said, good.
Oh, good. Yes, quite so. Yes, very good. I feel most pleased about it. As I pointed out to Pirbright, the risk of leaving her in her old quarters was far too great to be taken. Why, my dear Pilbeam, do you know that my sister Constance had actually invited that man Parslow to dinner tonight? Oh, yes, there he was at dinner with us. No doubt he had persuaded her to invite him, thinking that, having got into the place, he would be able to find an opportunity during the evening of slipping away and going down to the sty and doing the poor animal a mischief. A nice surprise he's going to get when he finds the sty empty. He won't know what to make of it. He'll be nonplussed.
Here Lord Emsworth paused to chuckle. Pilbeam, though not amused, contrived to emit on his side something that might have passed as a mirthful echo.
"This new sty," proceeded Lord Emsworth, having switched the torch on and off 6 times, "is an altogether more suitable place. As a matter of fact, I had it built specially for the Empress in the spring, but owing to Pirbright's obstinacy, I never moved her there. I don't know if you know these Shropshire fellows at all, Pilbeam, but they can be obstinate as Scotsmen. I have a Scots head gardener, Angus McAllister, and he is intensely obstinate, like a mule. I must tell you some time about the trouble I had with him regarding hollyhocks.
But Pertwright can be fully as stubborn when he gets an idea into his head. I reasoned with him. I said, Pertwright, this tie is a new tie, with all the latest improvements. It is up to date, in keeping with the trend of modern thought, and what is more, and this I consider very important, it adjoins the kitchen garden.
He broke off. A sound beside him in the darkness had touched his kindly heart.
Is your head hurting you again, my dear fellow?
But the bubbling cry which had proceeded from Percy Pilbeam had not been caused by pain in the head.
The kitchen garden?
He gasped.
Yes. And that is most convenient, you see, because Pertwright's cottage is so close. No doubt you've seen the place if you've ever strolled round by the kitchen garden. It is made of stout red brick and timber, with a good tiled roof. In fact, said Lord Emsworth, flashing his torch, here it is. And there, he went on with satisfaction, is the Empress, still feeding away without a care in the world. I told Pertwright he was all wrong.
The Empress might have been without a care in the world, but Percy Pilbeam was very far from sharing that ideal state. He leaned on the rail of the sty and groaned in spirit. In the light of the electric torch, Empress of Blandings made a singularly attractive, even a fascinating picture. She had her noble head well down, and with a rending, golloping sound, was tucking into her late supper. Her curly little tail wiggled incessantly, and ever and anon a sort of sensuous quiver would pass along her zeppelin-like body. But Percy Pilbeam was in no frame of mind to admire the rare and the beautiful. He was trying to adjust himself to this utterly unforeseen disaster. He had only himself to blame. That was what made it all the more bitter. If he had not so casually given his casting vote in favour of shifting this infernal pig to new quarters, he would not now have been faced by a problem which every moment seemed to become more difficult of solution. For Pilbeam was afraid of pigs. He seemed to remember having read somewhere that if you go into a pig's sty and the pig doesn't know you, it comes for you like a tiger and chews you to ribbons. Greedy though he was for Lord Tilbury's gold, something told him that never, no matter how glittering the reward, would he be able to bring himself to go into that sty in quest of the manuscript, guarded as it now was by this ravening beast. The prodigal son might have mixed with these animals on a clubby basis, but Percy Pilbeam knew himself to be incapable of imitating him. How long he would have stood there, savouring the bitterness of defeat, one cannot say. Left to himself, probably quite a considerable time, but his reverie had scarcely begun when it was shattered by a cry at his elbow.
God bless my soul!
It seemed to Pilbeam for an instant that he had come unstuck. He clutched the rail, quivering in every limb.
What on earth's the matter?
He demanded, far more brusquely than a guest should have done of his host. An agitation almost equal to his own was causing the torch to wobble in Lord Emsworth's hands.
God bless my soul! What's that she's eating? Pertwright! Pertwright! Can you see what she's eating, Pilbeam, my dear fella? Pertwright! Pertwright! Can it be paper?
With a febrile swoop, Lord Emsworth bent through the rails. He came up again, breathing heavily. The light of the torch came and went like a heliograph upon something which he held in his hand. Galloping feet sounded in the night.
Pertwright!
Yeah, my lord.
Pertwright, have you been giving the Empress paper?
No, my lord.
Well, that's what she's eating. Great chunks of it.
My lord?
Said the pigman, marvelling.
I assure you, yes, paper. Look! Well, God bless my soul, cried Lord Emsworth, at last steadying the torch. I'm dashed if it isn't that book of my brother Galahad's.
Chapter 14. At about the moment when Lord Emsworth had knocked at Percy Pilbeam's door to inquire after his health and make his kindly suggestion of a breath of fresh air, his sister, Lady Constance Keeble, his sister, Lady Julia Fish, and his neighbour and guest, Sir Gregory Parslow Parslow, were gathered together in the drawing-room, talking things over and endeavouring to come to some agreement as to the best method of handling the situation which had arisen. The tone of the meeting had been a little stormy from the very outset. Owing to the suddenness of his summons to the castle and the difficulty of explaining things over the telephone, all that Sir Gregory had known till now was the bare fact that Pilbeam had obtained possession of the manuscript and was proposing to deliver it to Lord Tilbury. Informed over the coffee cups by Lady Julia that the whole disaster was to be attributed to her sister Constance's tactless handling of the fellow, he had drawn his breath in sharply, gazed at Lady Constance in a reproachful manner, and started clicking his tongue. Any knowledgeable person could have guessed what would happen after that. No woman of spirit can sit calmly and have a man click his tongue at her. No hostess, on the other hand, can be openly rude to a guest. Seeking an outlet for her emotions, Lady Constance had begun to quarrel with Lady Julia. And as Lady Julia, always fond of a family row, had borne her end of the encounter briskly, before he knew where he was, Sir Gregory became aware that he had sown the wind and was reaping the whirlwind. We mention these things to explain why it happened that there was a certain delay before GHQ took the obvious step of trying to establish communication with Percy Pilbeam. More than a quarter of an hour had elapsed before Sir Gregory was able to still the tumult of battle with these arresting words.
"But I say, dash it, don't you think we ought to see the fella?"
They acted like magic. Angry passions were chained. Good things about to be said were corked up and stored away for use on some future occasion. The bell was rung for Beach. Beach was dispatched to Pilbeam's room with instructions to desire him to be so good as to step down to the drawing-room for a moment. And the end of it all was that Beach returned and announced that Mr. Pilbeam was not there. Consternation reigned.
"Not there?" cried Lady Constance. "Not there?" cried Lady Julia.
"But he must be there," protested Sir Gregory. "Fella goes into his room with a headache to lie down and have a sleep," he proceeded, arguing closely. "Stands to reason he must be there."
"You can't have knocked loudly enough, Beach," said Lady Constance.
"Go up and knock again," said Lady Julia.
"Hit the dash door a good hard bang," said Sir Gregory.
Beach's demeanour was respectful but unsympathetic. "Receiving no response to my knocking, milady, I took the liberty of entering the room. It was empty."
"Empty? Empty?
You mean," said Sir Gregory, who liked to get these things straight, "that there wasn't anybody in the room?"
Beach inclined his head. "The bedchamber was unoccupied," he assented.
"He may be in the smoking room," suggested Lady Constance. "Or the billiard room," said Lady Julia.
"Having a bath," cried Sir Gregory, inspired. "Fellow with a headache might quite easily go and have a bath. Do his headache good."
"I visited the smoking room and the billiard room, milady. The door of the bathroom on Mr. Pilbeam's floor was open, revealing emptiness within. I am inclined to think, milady," said Beach, "that the gentleman has gone for a walk." The awful words produced a throbbing silence. Only too well could these three visualize the direction in which, if he had taken a walk, Percy Pilbeam would have taken it.
"Thank you, Beach," said Lady Constance dully.
The butler bowed and withdrew. The silence continued unbroken. Sir Gregory walked heavily to the window and stood looking out into the night. It almost seemed to him that across that starry sky he could see written in letters of flame the story of the prawns. Lady Constance gave a shuddering sigh.
"We shan't have a friend left."
Lady Julia lit a cigarette.
"Poor old Miles. Bang goes his reputation."
Sir Gregory turned from the window.
"Those local committee chaps will give the nomination to old Billing now, I suppose."
His Regency buck face twisted with injured wrath.
"Why the devil need the fellow have been in such a hurry? Why couldn't he at least have let me talk to him? I brought my checkbook with me specially. He knows I'd have given him £500. I'll bet he won't get that from this Tilbury of his. I met Tilbury. I've heard stories about him. Mean man. Tight with his money. Pilbeam be lucky if he gets a couple of hundred out of him."
"A pity you put his back up like that, Connie," said Lady Julia suavely. "I don't suppose now he cares about the money so much. What he wants is to be nasty."
"What I think a pity," retorted Lady Constance with the splendid Keeble spirit, "is that Sir Gregory ever mentioned the matter to a man like this Pilbeam. He might have known that he was not to be trusted."
Exactly, said Lady Julia. An insane thing to do. This unexpected alliance disconcerted Sir Gregory Parslow. He spluttered.
Well, I had dealings with the fellow before on a private matter, and had found him alert and enterprising. I just went and engaged him naturally, as you would engage anyone to do something. It never occurred to me that he wasn't to be trusted.
Not even after you saw that moustache, said Lady Julia. Well, there's just one gleam of comfort in this business, Connie. We shall now be able to talk to Clarence and put a stop to any nonsense of his giving Ronnie his money. That's true, said Lady Constance, brightening a little. As she spoke, the door opened and Percy Pilbeam came in. End of side 13.